t'enverrai pas.
And we're back here on Unusual Sources 93.3 CFMU FM, broadcasting to Hamilton at 93.3 on the FM dial and to the rest of the world at cfmu.mcmaster.ca, our online streaming service. I'm very pleased today we have Eva Bartlett on the line with us. Eva Bartlett is a solidarity activist for Palestine. She's an independent journalist, and she's spent years, actually, in Palestine working on a number of causes and issues, and she's done so much writing for Canada and the internet on what's been happening in Gaza with Palestinian struggles and also the attacks that they're facing, so much work. And more recently, she's turned her attention to Syria because of the crisis there caused by Western intervention. And so I think we have Eva on the line with us. Eva, thanks very much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Brendan. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Well, we've done so much work even on this program with your Gaza-related broadcasts and of course, Syria, both the interviews we've done here and Taylor Report interviews that we've rebroadcast. And the truth is that you're one of the leading voices in Canada actually going out to Syria, visiting, staying in contact with people in the country, watching all the forms of media, not just Western or Syrian, but Gulf or Arab media, anyone who's reporting on this, trying to keep up with the situation. I guess we're facing a problem right now, and it is more yellow journalism. You know, I mean, every time this group that's called the Syrian Rebels is about to lose a position somewhere, we suddenly get all these human rights stories popping up out of nowhere about some kind of horrible thing that the Syrian government is supposed to have done. And I guess the latest in the string of such incidents is what was being reported with regard to Madaya. And I understand that, you know, you see it on Facebook, people will retweet or reblog or post all sorts of things that they've heard, you know, from secondhand or third-hand sources about this village in Syria and similar things. And it turns out to be quite untrue what people are posting, and we just seem to never learn from this. In the case of Madaya, I understand there were photos taken, and we're told about the siege and starvation and all these things. But photos coming from that village weren't even from there. I was wondering if you could tell us about this sort of the general situation that we're seeing on Facebook and social media and how this imagery has often been completely inaccurate.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. I mean, the photos that had been posted by several mainstream outlets, including BBC, including Al Jazeera, and many, many others, including CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Company, many of these photos were recycled from other places where they were purported to have occurred in Syria, or in fact, not even in Syria. There were photos that were found from the UK and from other parts of the world. And there's one rather well-known instance now of a young girl from South Lebanon whose family actually came on, I believe it might have been Al-Mayadeen, but they came on media and they said, look, this is our daughter. She's not from Madaya. She's not starving. Here she is healthy. And let the little girl speak. But her photo had been used to purport that she was one of these so-called starving civilians in Madaya. I mean, numerous people have deconstructed this. I would highly recommend an interview one of my colleagues, Vanessa Beely, did on the UK column. And she very articulately deconstructs all this propaganda on Madaya. So we have the use of these photos that turn out not to be from Madaya. We also have different so-called human rights groups putting forth the lies that were put forth on Madaya, and at the same time negating the real suffering of other areas in Syria, which we'll get to later on. So another aspect of the whole Madaya thing was that these mainstream reports also, most of them neglected to really highlight the fact that Madaya is infested with about 600 terrorists. Roughly 60% are from Ahrar al-Sham, 30% are Jabhat al-Nusra, which is al-Qaeda in Syria, and 10% are the so-called non-existent Free Syrian Army. So these terrorists are in Madaya. They are the ones, and this is by all rights, by all statements of civilians in Madaya. When aid did get in earlier, a week or two ago, different media went in, including Russia Today, and Al-Manar, and they interviewed residents of Madaya, and these residents were saying, look, the problem is not the Syrian government or the Syrian army. The problem is these terrorists have stolen whatever aid came in, and they are either not giving it to us or they're selling it at just thuggish, extortionist rates.
Well, you know, I just got to say, what you're doing here is something that journalism, like in the outlets you mentioned, CBC, BBC, Al Jazeera, just isn't doing, which is you're actually looking at the situation on the ground, what's actually happening there. So you're going beyond these emotional images, which have been taken from elsewhere, from not in Madaya, that are designed to evoke a certain emotional response, and you're saying, well, what's happening on the ground? So you've pointed out there's Jabhat al-Nusra, or one of these al-Qaeda-linked groups operating there, along with a similar allied group. So the people holding that town, the people that are in that town then, are these groups that are affiliated with the al-Qaeda-style organizations.
Yeah, I mean, so you do have genuine civilians who are suffering. But again, the point is their suffering is not due to the Syrian government or Syrian army. Their suffering is due to the presence of these terrorists. And the reason there is a military siege surrounding the town is because it's from places like where terrorists are embedded. These terrorists are firing rockets and missiles on outlying areas. So, of course, they do need to prevent the flow of these terrorists from leaving Madaya into other areas. But the fact is, the suffering that does exist there, it doesn't compare to other areas like Fu and Kafaria, which we'll get to, or Nuwal and Zahra, which we'll also get to. It doesn't compare by any means to the suffering in those places. But at the same time, because the media, because there's an agenda by all the different leaders and factions and regimes that want to overthrow the Syrian government, they are focusing on Madaya. Is the new Yarmouk. Before, it was the Yarmouk, and it was the fault of the Syrian government, which it was not. It was the fault of the terrorists, and now it is Madaya. And these same talking heads don't even talk about Yarmouk now, which still has terrorists, which are still terrorizing the remaining people within.
Yes, you brought up a number of good points there. I wanted to just focus in on a moment on Madaya. So you've pointed out this city or this village is occupied by illegal invading forces in Syria that come from these various regimes and countries that are not allowed to send people into Syria. So they're illegally occupying a town, and the interviews with the residents have happened. There's been video interviews, and you've been able to get coverage out of there, and they're complaining that these occupying forces are the ones that are mishandling food or denying them food.
Right. So for example, Russia Today's reporter Murad Gazdiev, when he went into Madaya, when the aid was allowed in, he was tweeting things like, Madaya civilians say rebels charged 100,000 Syrian pounds, which is equivalent roughly of $250, for a kilogram of rice. Another tweet, many Madaya civilians weeping at joy for finally leaving this place, says ISIS or Daesh in town, fight with rebels. And more tweets along the line of blaming rebels, so-called rebels, for cruelty theft. And, you know, there are some other important points that, again, the most of the corporate media glossed over, and that is, for example, the spokesperson for the Red Cross on October 19th said that aid had entered Madaya and there was enough to last for 2 months. So this whole, you know, starvation, okay, October 19th, there's aid for 2 months, that takes us to December 19th, and suddenly by January, there's all this starvation. Well, if that's the case, if there are cases of starvation, it isn't due to a lack of aid getting into the town. It's due to terrorists stealing the aid.
Yeah, well, I've seen photos of the occupying soldiers in there, and they don't look hungry. I have never seen one of them go hungry or starving. They all seem to have a good supply of food, even if the residents' food is in doubt. So basically, you have a situation where rebels, as they're called, have occupied this place, and they're the ones handling distribution and provisioning of food, and they've made a big deal about it here by not looking at the ground, who occupies the place or what's going on. They actually showed photos that didn't even come from the place. So they just want to get an emotional response that something bad is happening, and you need outside forces to go and make the situation better.
Precisely, and also the Syrian ambassador, Dr. Al-Jafri, in a January statement at the UN, he pointed out the fact that the Syrian government had facilitated and even requested food and you know, humanitarian aid deliveries to these various areas, Madaya, Al-Fua, Kafaria, and other areas, Nuwal and Zahra. And he made an important point saying, let me find it, that on December 27th, the Syrian government, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, requested that the United Nations urgently deliver humanitarian assistance, including medical assistance and fuel, to those places, and that the UN did not send this assistance, And when the government asked why, the UN said, we're facing logistical problems. We're not responsible for this. Okay, so what is their logistical problem? If they're able to coordinate with these terrorists to enter aid, at that time when the Syrian government was urgently requesting aid be sent, the UN didn't do its part. And I'd just like to add another part with respect to the UN. So I just looked at their Twitter feed, and the body of the UN, OCHA, Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, their tweets were incredibly biased. So we'll get to Kafaria and Fu in a minute, but basically their situation has been dire, especially since March 2015. And there's a statement from the UN resident coordinator for Syria, Yaqub al-Helu, in late March, saying he was gravely concerned about that area and the possible impact on hundreds of thousands of civilians. He's talking about the greater Idlib area. But so they make that point, and they're very aware that Kfaria and Fula are surrounded by terrorists. And yet, from that time in March until December 28th, in their Twitter feed, OCHA doesn't once mention al-Fula and Kfaria. On the other hand, from the first time they mentioned it, December 28th, until when I wrote this article, January 14th, the statistics for their mentioning Madaya and Fua Kafaria, Madaya got 17 specific mentions, and Fua and Kafaria got 6. And their situations are dramatically different. Fua and Kafaria, the people are suffering. So the UN is also complicit in, you know, along with all these different human rights groups, so-called human rights groups, in whitewashing and obscuring the reality.
Right, okay, so you have all the attention in the world focused on this one area, and they're not even telling us actually what's happening there, treating us like children or babies, basically. But you mentioned these other two towns. So there's other places under siege in Syria. You mentioned the name. What's happening there, you know, and why isn't it being covered?
Sure, so they're two villages northeast of Idlib in the north of Syria, and they've been partially besieged by terrorists for over 4 years, but they've been fully besieged by these terrorist factions, again, Nusra, Al-Qaeda in Syria, Jaish al-Fatah, Ahrar al-Sham, and other factions. They've been surrounded. These terrorist factions are denying any sort of food aid, assistance, gas for generators, etc. The terrorists have attacked their water resources. And so these people have been, again, at least since March 2015, under full siege. The only way they've been able to get supplies is if the Syrian army is able to airdrop supplies, but that is very dangerous because these terrorists will shoot at the helicopters. But that said, the army has been at times been able to drop supplies, but it's never that accurate. It doesn't always land in these villages.
Wait, so these guys are being besieged by this group called the Syrian Rebels?
The various different factions that are all so-called moderates, that are all terrorists, yes.
So those towns, yeah, they can't get the food aid, but the Syrian government is trying to get the aid in. So you say that the hunger situation there is even more dire than in Madaya.
It is, because, again, they've been totally besieged since March 2015, and they've been still fighting off these terrorists for the last 4 years. And, like, I wrote about this back in August 2015, and even back then the situation was quite dire, a lack of medicines, no fuel to run the generators. This affects the little medical equipment or, you know, hospital machinery that they have, which is, I imagine, very little. And more recently, my colleague Vanessa interviewed Dr. Ali Mustafa, who's the head surgeon there, and he's saying that it's extremely dire, that there is no electricity, that people are burning trees just to stay warm. And in terms of how it affects the medical situation there, they can't do operations. Their medical procedures they can't do. And, I mean, we've seen photos coming. These have been verified photos, not these propaganda photos of Madaya. We've seen actual photos coming from Fua Kafaria of children who are suffering, a girl who died of malnutrition on January 13th, and other people that have serious conditions that are not getting treatment for. And these villages, I mean, if the media does address them at all, it's very much in passing, and it's also with this sectarian slant that the Western and Gulf media like to do when they talk about Syria, because they're the media and the Gulf states are the ones inflaming any sort of sectarianism in secular Syria. So if they do talk about the villages, they say the Shia villages. Well, the villages are predominantly Shia, but again, when I was talking with this one friend who's from Kafaria, he told me, look, Eva, yes, it's predominantly Shia, but we've always, we've had intermarriages with other faiths. We've always welcomed, we've always coexisted with our brothers and sisters, you know, in surrounding areas. So this whole sectarian slant is just meant to, it's just meant to continue the Western agenda of making this a sectarian issue, when it's really about secular Syria versus these, you know, imperialist and Zionist forces.
We really have to emphasize the sectarian language that's being used here, because, you know, sometimes there are attacks, these rocket attacks or whatever, by these rebels on villages and towns, and newspapers might say, well, you know, that's a regime village. You know, it's predominantly made of government supporters. So in a kind of, they're trying in an offhand way sort of justify, these things. So again, you mentioned Shia villages. So, that's a village that contains Shia. So, you know, maybe it's acceptable for these rebels to just, starve them and strangle them and surround them. And that's not the language of the Syrian government. The Syrian government is a government, as you mentioned, It's a secular government in which Sunni, Shia, Alawi, all these different groups can exist legally and without discrimination. But the rebels that have been coming in there have been extremely sectarian, and they have been using the language of the Gulf media. We see that throughout the Middle East, actually. So if ISIS or a similar group attacks, you know, a neighborhood in somewhere in Lebanon, in Beirut, it'll be called... that's a Hezbollah neighborhood. You know, that's a Hezbollah supporting neighborhood. So that's why it happened. As if the presence of an ethnicity or group of political supporters justifies attacks by ISIS or al-Nusra or al-Qaeda or these other groups.
Precisely, and that's what the media does. They negate the loss of human life and actual suffering there. So with regards to the November 12th terrorist bombings in Bush Barajni in Beirut, there were 44, at least 44, it could be higher by now, due to people dying of critical injuries, say 44 people who were killed. And I'm working on an article on this because, as you were saying, any media that covered, any dominant Western media that covered it was sure to say this was a Hezbollah stronghold or a militant stronghold. But I went there with a delegation, and we walked through the streets. We saw, first of all, what the media did not highlight was this was a residential and commercial area. And that when the bombings took place, it was just before school would have gotten out. So thankfully, you know, there were not more people who were killed and injured, more children. But nonetheless, it took place in a very around 6 o'clock at a busy time. People were on the street, you know, shops, residential apartment buildings. And you know, I walked through there with a Palestinian friend from the camp of Bush Barajni, which is different but not far away. And there was a double-faceted element to this. One was that the media just painted it as a so-called Hezbollah stronghold. The other was that immediately they accused Palestinians of having been behind the attacks, when it later transpired they were not. So they were trying to fuel some sort of strife between Palestinians and the residents of this neighborhood. But as we walked through there, my Palestinian friend told me, look, this is not just so-called Hezbollah neighborhood. There are Christians living here. There are Palestinians living here. There are Sunnis living here. So that's the Bush Barajni attack, and that got, you know, again, very little mention, and this was not long, I believe it was after the Paris attacks, which of course got everybody to change their Facebook profile photos to a French flag. Then you have the many attacks. We'll just look at one area of Homs, a district called Al-Zahra, which is another area which the corporate media likes to paint as an Alawi district. It is predominantly Alawi, but it also comprises Christian, Shia, and Sunni. And I've been looking at the different reports. So you have December 12th, there was a triple terrorist bombing. It was a car bomb parked next to a natural gas delivery truck, which caused a second explosion. And some hours later, a terrorist came back and exploded his suicide belt. So, and of course, just like the Zionists do, you know, waiting until the rescuers and people come to help, and then they explode themselves or they bomb. So in this attack, at least 16 people were killed, according to Syrian state media. Then 2 weeks later, on December 28th, again, terrorists struck, killing at least 19, according to Syrian media. And just recently, just on January 26th, yesterday, again, terrorists struck. And so these are, you know, I went there 3 days after the December 12th bombings, and I spoke with people. I saw the destruction, and these are very real people. These are not just an Alawi neighborhood. These are people who are suffering immensely from repeated terrorism that the Syrian government has requested again and again and again that the UN Security Council condemn it And they won't. They won't condemn this terrorism. They won't condemn the mortar and rocket and hell cannon terrorism.
I remember, Eva, when a group of moderate rebels went into a town and they put some people in a cage. And they put them in a cage to ward off airstrikes. They didn't. They figured the Syrian government would not attack them if they put these civilians in a cage. And later they were trying to justify it, and it was mentioned, well, you know, the people we put in there, they were Alawi. They were Alawi, and you know, that's why we put them in the cage, because, you know, we couldn't rely on them or whatever reason. See, the ethnicity or the religious beliefs, the faith of people becomes a justification for harming them in the language of the Syrian opposition. And it relates, again, as I say, to the Gulf states and the United States plan as well. If you look at things like everything from Project to a New American Century to Condoleezza Rice talking about the new Middle East to maps that were published in prominent U.S. newspapers, they keep talking about dividing up countries into constituent parts, saying things like Iraq is not a real country, or Syria is not a real country, Libya is not a real country, and we need to change those countries, and we need to create a Sunni stan and a Shia stan, and, you know, these ethnicities just can't work together, and we need to break up those countries and create these new ones. And so you have outside powers coming in and saying, you know, we think the Middle East should look different. And how that translates on the ground is you have these armed militias armed by Saudi Arabia and Qatar and Turkey, United States, and they have the language saying, well, you guys are Shia, you got to go, you're Alawi, we're going to put you in a cage, other, you know, if you don't agree with us, we're going to kill you. And that's how these policies of breaking up the Middle East get translated on the ground into these kind of sectarian actions.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, this has never been every time I've gone to Syria four times since April 2014, and every time I've gone to whatever district, be it Latakia or Homs or Sweida or Damascus, Syrians that I've met have stressed, we didn't know sectarianism until this happened, and it's not from Syria, it's from without. In fact, when I was in Al-Zahra at the site of the terrorist bombing, some man, he just wanted me to be sure I understood that, first of all, these terrorists are not real Muslims. They're not acting under Islamic beliefs. These are just plain and simple terrorists, or, as we know, mercenaries in many cases. And also they rejected the sectarianism. And everywhere I've gone, they've made a point of this. And in fact, I once did the taboo thing in Latakia, and I asked a group of women who were sitting in a park. And Latakia, in general, has been more safe, except for the rockets from outside, the terrorist rockets. But anyway, these women were sitting smoking water pipe or nargila, and some of them were wearing veils and some of them were not. And I didn't want to play the part of a Western reporter making sectarian lines, but I wanted to make the point that here's a group of people coexisting, and, you know, this is what Syrians have always said to me. And it turned out that the group was mixed, of course, as you would expect, some Christian, some Muslim. And, you know, so everywhere I've gone, including meeting with Syria's Grand Mufti, Mufti Hassoun, he himself says he's the Mufti of all Syrians, not of Muslims. So this is a thing that's deeply ingrained in the fabric of Syrian society. And like you say, all this disgusting Wahhabi sectarianism is coming from outside, from Saudi, from Qatar. And the Zionist entity as well has a huge role in destabilizing Syria.
And, you know, you keep mentioning those rockets that al-Nusra and other groups are using. I've seen photos. They put them on social media. They take pictures of their rockets, and they're very proud because they're homemade. They're propane bombs. They take propane and put rockets on the propane tank, and then they launch it from the back of a truck. And, I mean, obviously these are not very well-guided weapons, they get into a fight with Syrian army or whomever, and they just launch a bunch of propane tanks on rockets into cities, and the devastation must be immense from these. I wonder how many of these alleged barrel bombs used by the Syrian government are actually these propane rockets, which are manufactured by the dozen in Syria, according to the photos that are put up by these groups. It's staggering. But, you know, you mentioned also one more thing I wanted to cover before we go, and that is Yarmouk. You say that there's a sort of pattern going on here where media, Western media, social media, human rights groups focus on a particular city or incident to the detriment of all other things. And then when the narrative isn't going their way or they want to talk about something else, they just forget about it and move on. So there had been a lot of noise about Yarmouk. You want to tell us, I mean, how that was covered or what happened there, and now how we've all forgotten about it?
Yeah, and I should mention, I meant to make this point before, but regarding Madaya, the Syria's ambassador, Dr. Al-Jafri, ambassador to the UN, he also made the point that, you know, whenever there's going to be important peace talks or important meetings, something like this, some sort of media campaign flares up. And that was the case with Yarmouk as well. Yarmouk was used as a card against the Syrian government and Syrian army many times, but now it's you don't even hear the name Yarmouk mentioned in the media because that's not the talking point. But basically, it was infested by terrorists in 2012, and 2013, the Syrian army imposed a siege to keep the flow of terrorists from entering into Damascus, because Yarmouk is right on the edge. It's a neighborhood, the district of Damascus. So from getting to the Damascus center, a siege was put on the neighborhood. Now, the Syrian government has actually facilitated the evacuation of residents of Yarmouk, and I visited two different centers where people were being housed. One was a UN center, but the other was a center in a government-secured neighborhood wherein the people were receiving aid and supplies from the government. And in fact, I was surprised to see that Sky News actually, when was this? I have to go through my notes here. They actually covered the fact that, you know, during protests, there was one incident where there was a protest, and this happened many times, but in one incident where there was a protest, the protesters came under fire by the terrorists. And the protesters were actually protesting the presence of these terrorists. And so his May 2013 report was saying, he quoted someone saying, "Someone screamed at us, please tell the world the truth. We don't want the fighters here. We want the army to kill them." And that said, the Syrian army's strategy has been to be as careful as possible. They haven't been, as the media would have you believe it, they haven't been just wiping out entire neighborhoods. They've been waging careful ground operations whenever possible. I'd like to recommend, with regards to Yarmouk, a couple of articles, one by Sharmeen Narwani. It's not specific to Yarmouk, but it does address Yarmouk, and it's called Who Dragged the Palestinians into the Syria Conflict? And the other by another colleague of mine, Paul Rudy, who said, whose article is titled Who Are the Starving and Besieged Residents of Yarmouk? And he gets into the fact that the population of Yarmouk were actually facilitated, their evacuation was facilitated, and those who chose to stay would be supporters of these armed factions. In some cases, on the other hand, he and others acknowledge that there are some that are unable to leave for whatever reason. But right now, I went to Yarmouk. I was at the edge of Yarmouk on my last visit to Syria. And it is, unfortunately, the district is about 75% under control of the different terrorist gangs. But one thing to note is that now there's only apparently between 4,000 to 5,000 people in Yarmouk, whereas before this neighborhood was over 1 million. Now, when the media was talking about Yarmouk, their talking points were barrel bombs. I'm sorry, I can't say barrel bombs properly anymore. and that the Syrian government was starving the population, even though in reality the Syrian government was sending in aid and facilitating aid, but in the same situation as Madaya, terrorists within Yarmouk were stealing the aid. When I went to Yarmouk this time, I met with one of the Palestinian leaders there, Abu Kifaa Ghazi, and he was saying that he again reiterated how the government facilitated the entry of aid into Yarmouk. And he also said that, you know, he pointed out the fact that Palestinians, they are actually have the security of Yarmouk within the district, and there are many Palestinian groups that are fighting against the terrorists. I wasn't able to get that far into Yarmouk because it was dusk and there were risk of being shot by snipers. But the fact is that Yarmouk is now no longer a talking point, and soon, you know, tomorrow, Madaya will not be a talking point because it served the agenda of the shameful corporate media.
Yeah, I hope people realize this. It's just like in Libya with, you know, Gaddafi giving Viagra to soldiers. Mm-hmm. And it turns out not to be true, but it's too late because already people get whipped up into a frenzy. They get mobilized and they say, we need a no-fly zone. We need to bring NATO aircraft in there. We need to destroy the ground forces of this government and put in the nice, good, clean rebels that'll make things better, just like they did in Libya, for example. And, you know, we have time for people to grow up and say, and when the media gives you some story like that, World War One style propaganda where they said, you know, Germans are bayoneting babies or whatever. You know, you got to say, well, actually, I think I should investigate this on my own. I should consult alternative sources because we've been lied to over and over again, not just once, but on every conflict in recent history, from Yugoslavia to Iraq to Libya and now in Syria, where there have been many such lies. So people have to actually sort of automatically or by default reflexively say no to the propaganda because overall, yeah, people like you have been doing yeoman work and you've been right. And, we were right in 2003 when we said Iraq doesn't have these kind of weapons that could flatten London in 45 minutes and, that you shouldn't invade Iraq. We were right when we said, you know, this no-fly zone in Libya is a bad thing. It could turn into something worse. Don't do this. We're right, but yet we're the ones who are silenced and marginalized. And I think, you know, people have to be taking more responsibility when they read these, inflammatory stories on social media.
Yeah, and you know, what strikes me about many so-called leftists in the West is their arrogance, their supreme arrogance, that they are not willing to believe 5 years into this bloody war on Syria, they are not willing to believe that the people of Syria have made their decision, that they chose their government, and that they don't want foreign intervention. They're so arrogant that they want to still believe there's something called a revolution in Syria, and they deny the Syrian people's voices, and this really infuriates me. And I met with Dr. Bhutani Shaban, who is the advisor to the president, and she was saying, you know, the way the Western media, and I'm adding the way leftists in the West, treat the Syrian voice is as if they, she said it's like the colonizer to the colonized, that the colonizer is always the truthful one, and the colonizer is always the truthful one, and colonized are, you know, somehow inherently not worthy of trust. But, you know, something else I'm working on, is an article on Syrian journalists who, you know, we have to respect the different people, whether they're Syrian soldiers or National Defense Forces that are defending Syria, but also brave Syrian journalists who are reporting what's actually happening in Syria. And again, Western media negates their voices. But there are a number of incredibly brave and factual journalists that are reporting what's happening in Syria. And I just wish that these people that I get into debates with on social media who are sitting in their armchairs in their comfortable existence in the West, I wish they would stop, because they believe these media lies about the Syrian government. You know, I wish they would, like you say, grow up and actually look at some alternative reports and recognize what the Syrian people have chosen and what they want and stop trying to impose this foreign attempt to overthrow the government of Syria.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, after 15 years of what they call the war on terror, why would you believe the media when it's reporting on Syria or Iraq or Iran or Libya or any of these countries where they want regime change or to do other things to these countries? I mean, they've been wrong over and over again, and the sort of the burden of proof is on the media and the White House and our governments because they've been wrong and they've lied openly, and we're just supposed to forget about that, move on, and accept the next lie. But you, as I said, have done yeoman work. You've collected a lot of information. You've written a lot of articles, and people, they can turn to alternative sources. You have your blog. That's ingaza.wordpress.com, right?
That's correct, yes.
In Gaza, so it's just one word, ingaza.wordpress.com, and there's other sources. I'll put some of those links on the internet, so the ones you mentioned that we can get them on, just you can click right to them from this program. So I'm very glad you did this work. It's so important, and it's so important that voices that are exposing this be heard once again, just like in the days of the Iraq War, when there were massive protests against that, because this is not entirely different from what was happening there. It's just a somewhat different strategy and approach that the Pentagon has chosen. So I really appreciate the work you've done, and I appreciate your blog. Thanks for putting that up. We'll get people to that. And so thanks very much for being on our program today.
My pleasure, Brendan. It's always a pleasure to talk with you. You're a very well-informed person and host, and I really appreciate the work that you do.
Well, thanks very much, Eva. We'll catch you later.
Okay. Bye-bye. Bye.
And that was Eva Bartlett, a journalist, Palestine solidarity activist. And if I'm well informed, it's because of blogs like In Gaza, and many of the other programs that we refer to on this station, for example. Stephen Gowans, gowans.wordpress.com. There's someone who has regularly contributed on Syria, really exposed a lot of the regular propaganda that comes out. There's all sorts of sources you can turn to. You just have to be able to use your brain and think and filter out information and decide for yourself. Because if you rely on, you know, whatever corporate media you've got on your iPhone giving you updates, you're going to have a bad time. But thanks very much for Eva and the work she did there. And we'll provide some of those links on our internet broadcast. We'll be right back.